for Danny's gambling losses. She puffed under smoke without taking her unblinking eyes off him, a remarkable feat, he had to concede.
How do you know they did?
He's still alive, and so are you.
I'm just a bit thrown here, I have to admit. I was ready for a very different afternoon with you. No talking, no thinking, just some time with me, right here,
she said, patting the bed. So the debts?
What possible business is it of yours?
If it makes you feel better, Mallory Green and Alice Jacoby have the same issues with their husbands. Bart Green's is just on a bigger scale.
Well, I'm sure Mallory will be able to handle it.
He's lost millions of dollars gambling, Gloria. Now, maybe you could pay that back with your J.P. Morgan and U.S. Trust inheritance, but Mallory doesn't have those kinds of assets.
Bart makes a lot of money.
Not that much, he said.
What can I tell you?
I was hoping more than you have. So Green never came to you for money?
If she did, why should I tell you?
Maybe you just did. How about Alice? Did she put the ask on you for bailout money?
As I told you before, Archer, I never touch the principal.
But what about a little interest? You probably have a bit to share for an old friend. She dropped her gaze.
If you must know, yes, I did help a little. But that was all.
Did you find some spare change for your husband, too?
Can you find your own way out, or do I have to call one of the servants to show you?
He slowly walked over to the door.
Oh, Archer?
He turned to see her standing there, all confidence and swagger, her hands on her hips.
Just take a good, long look at my bedroom, tall, dark, and stupid, because you'll never see it again.
Yep, Archer thought. The warrior just got me with her sword right in the gut. Chapter 54. In the hotel lobby, Archer phoned Mallory Green's house after getting the number from the directory. Green's personal assistant, Sally, answered and told him that Green had flown to Lake Tahoe. That's right, I remember now. It was actually the pilot, Steve Everett, who had told him that. Do you have the phone number and address up there? She wanted me to fill her in on developments. She gave this information to him, and Archer wrote it down in his notebook. Later, he drove to the Formosa, where he walked into the red train car that the owner, Jimmy Bernstein, a former prize fighter from New York, had attached to the building to give him more space for customers to spend money and have a good time. Being across the street from the Goldwyn studio, the Formosa saw its share of stars. Archer wasn't guessing about this. There were hundreds of autographed pictures on the walls, with everyone from William Powell to Joan Crawford represented. He waited until 7 on the dot and ordered a Gibson with a trio of onions. It was delivered to his table at just the moment a back door entrance opened. Sidling into the train car was a woman wearing a long black coat, a broad-brimmed black hat, and sunglasses big enough to hide most of her face. She spotted Archer and headed over, depositing herself in the chair across from him with her back to the entrance. She took her hat off, revealing the platinum blonde hair, but kept the glasses on. She smiled at Archer and set her plastic purse on the table, then took a sip of her Gibson and slowly put it back down.
God, that tastes so damn good.
Must be the extra onions. They do it every time. She smiled.
I don't even know your name. You signed the note. Sincerely, I'm cute. Nice touch.
Name's Archer, Miss Lords.
Please, just call me Sam. And Samantha's not my real name. Pretty much every star out here has changed theirs. Many of them because they're Jewish. Heaven forbid, right?
Right. What film are you working on?
Does it really matter? The next one before the next one. They're paying me so much money I could never spend it all.
But other people could, so be careful. Lots of stars end up with nothing. Don't be one of them, Sam. She took another drink while he sipped on his scotch on the rocks.
How's your hand?
He flexed it. I'm a fast healer.
I didn't think I'd hear from you.
To confess, I didn't know your name until I saw it on a movie poster. No knock against you. I'm a nobody and you're a star, but I'm just not much of a movie guy.
It's actually refreshing. I almost didn't answer your note. But you seem like, well, like a nice guy. Not a swooner or a grifter. And I can usually spot them.
She set the drink down.
So, it seems you had a close call at the Jade.
I also had a close call in Vegas with the guy who runs the Jade, Darren Paley. Almost ended up residing forever in the desert. She reacted to the name in a way that surprised Archer.
I think he has a lot of close calls like that with people. Only, most of them don't get away like you did.
So you know who he is? Asked Archer curiously. She made a face that Archer couldn't quite read.
I know what he is. You got a cigarette?
He shook out a Lucky and lit it for her. She blew the smoke to the wall and lifted the Gibson with her free hand. It was a pretty hand, Archer observed. But there were indications of old calluses on the palm and fingers, along with a certain strength. The lady had known hard manual work, he concluded. She noted him looking, eyed her hand, and said,
I grew up in Minnesota, like I told you. On a farm, lot of hard work and heavy lifting, riding mules and horses. I still like riding horses, only now I do it for pleasure. Back then, it was just so we could eat or get from one place to another.
I can see that. She tapped her ash into the ashtray.
Can you, Archer? Then you're in rare company in this town.
I didn't grow up on a farm. I grew up poor in a city where every day you could see all the things you would never have.
I think that might be as bad as living on a farm with nothing to see except how little you have.
They're both tough.
As soon as I turned 15, I got out of there. Saved money, got on a bus, and left. And that trip, let me tell you, I could write a book on it.
I bet. She blew smoke out and rested her chin on her knuckles.
But MGM doesn't want me to ever mention where I came from. It's apparently too common. And people don't like to lay down dough for movie tickets to watch. Common. So the studio invented a past for me, and I can tell you for a fact, it's simply marvelous.
She took off her glasses, dipping her gaze for the moment before swinging it up to him, and giving him a look that froze him to his bones with its sultry, honest frankness. He didn't know if this was a perfected signature movie move of hers or not, but she did it with a lot of class, exhibiting both a fragility and a longing that made one ache, or at least it did him. She smiled at his reaction, and the look vanished instantly.
You should see me do that shtick with the right lighting. They say the difference between being a film star and a run-of-the-mill actress is how good your lighting guy is.
Okay.
You see, Archer, this is a fantasy town, and I'm now part of that fantasy.
You can choose not to be. Go back to Minnesota.
I think about that a lot. Some days I almost work up the courage to do it.
Why can't you go all the way? Her wide eyes became sad and distant.
Because working your fingers to the bone on a farm in the middle of nowhere for peanuts is not all that great either. I busted my butt to escape it, in fact. That makes it hard to rush back to. At least here I can mostly call my own shots. And the money? I make more in one day than I'd make in a lifetime working that farm.
Money's not everything.
It is if you never had much of it.
You still have any family left?
My parents are dead. I have two sisters. They think I'm an evil hussy who has blackened the family name.
What was your real name?
I'll take that to the grave, thank you very much. So, why did Paley want to kill you?
Maybe I know more than I should know. At least, about what he's doing.
And what do you know?
Some of what I saw that night. He glanced at her pupils. They were normal. She noticed his scrutiny. Lourdes said sharply,
When I work, I don't play. And I worked today.
Okay. But you may get to the point where your body doesn't give you a choice. Furrows covered her lovely brow.
Is that why you asked to meet with me? To lecture me? Because others have tried and failed.
No, I said my piece the first night I saw you.
And I said my piece right back.
How well do you know Paley?
Pretty well, considering I was married to Darren for 2 years.
Archer just sat there for a few moments. It had been a long time since he had been that stunned.
Yeah, I didn't think you knew about that. I was only 17.
17?
Really young and even more stupid. We didn't meet out here. It was in Reno. I tried to make it as a dancer and singer there after escaping the farm. I met Darren. He was a lot older than me. An ex-con, all tough and smooth and dangerous, and involved in some shady deals with some seriously bad people. And he swept me right off my little naive farm girl feet. Then it became apparent we were not a good match, and we got a quickie divorce. In that regard, Reno was perfect. It was mutual, by the way. Darren had already moved on to another woman before we separated. And then the war started and he joined up, and I came out here and finally got the brass ring. When he got out of uniform, I heard Darren went to Vegas and started working at the Flamingo.
Bugsy Siegel and those boys? She tapped her ash in the ashtray.
Yeah, he was their enforcer, and he was really, really good at it. He did a bunch of stuff for them and for himself, and then he came here.
I think he was pulling double duty between Vegas and L.A. during that time.
How do you mean?
He was operating a gambling ring for the mob out of Chinatown about 5 years ago. Cost a friend of mine the use of his legs. He blew town after that, and then he came back to run the Jade. Maybe with the mob's blessing and participation.
Nothing Darren did or will do would surprise me.
You said you were 17 when you got married?
And 19 when we got divorced. I'm 30 now. I've got maybe, 10 good years left for pictures. I've got to hoof it while the hoofing is good. And don't worry. I invest my money in blue chip stocks and government bonds and prime real estate. And I have ownership pieces in some of the best restaurants and nightclubs in L.A. I'll be sitting pretty when I blow this joint and go wherever I go.
And when Darren got to town and found out you were a big star, what did he want? She finished off her Gibson and raised her hand for another. After it was delivered, she said,
Why do you think I go to the Jade?
He's blackmailing you. With what?
Let's just say that while we were married, I helped my husband with some of his business dealings, and some people got hurt. I mean, really hurt. I knew nothing about any of it, of course. I was just a kid. But Darren doesn't care. He could make my life miserable, and my career would flame out just like that.
She snapped her fingers.
And if you repeat that to anybody, I'll sue your ass off and take everything you have.
I don't repeat things, and I don't have much to take. But if he spills, he'll bring himself down.
I've got a lot more to lose than he does, Archer. And Darren always lands on his feet. Always. He's the cat of all cats.
They're filming you at the Jade.
I know they are, but only from the ceiling angle. They sell it to the Japs and the Chinese and the South Americans. And maybe here too, who the hell knows. They just see the top of my platinum blonde head. And then the rest of me. Nobody knows it's the wonderful Samantha Lourdes, of course. He makes money, and when Darren makes money, he lays off me. And that makes it worth it.
And you get others to go there too? Your fellow stars? She looked down into her glass, her expression flexing to despondency.
He wants me to, but I keep making excuses. I don't want anyone I care about to get mixed up with that man. He was bad in Reno. Now he's far worse. Maybe it was the war, or maybe it was the stuff he did for Bugsy and that crowd. Whatever. He really scares me. But I'm running out of excuses with him, and I'm not the only star there. I can tell you that.
And he got you hooked on drugs? She sat up.
No, in fairness, I can't blame Darren for that. It was all my doing. I dabbled when I was married to him. Darren won't touch the stuff. He doesn't even drink booze. He has to always be in control. Me, I kept dabbling. Now the studio feeds it to me, so I'll keep working my cute little ass off for them. But I'm not hooked. Not per se.
I don't think there's any per se when it comes to being an addict.
You might be surprised. I only take 10% of the stuff they throw my way. Same at the Jade. It's starting to bore me, actually. I might just chuck it all one day and be dry as a bone with pupils that don't go pop anymore.
She shot him a curious glance.
So, is Darren coming for you?
At some point he will. For now he's lying low after his boys blew the hit on me. It was close. They were already digging the grave and about to drill a bullet into my skull when the cavalry arrived and saved my butt. She reached out and took his hand, her features now full of sincere concern.
Archer, don't mess with that psycho. He won't miss again.
I'm not sure I have much choice in the matter.
You could hop a train or a plane and head east. Far, far east.
I can do a lot of things. But then Paley will still be here doing what he does to people, like you. How does that make the world a better place? She sat back and gazed at him in wonderment.
What are you? A preacher? Or an idiot? Or both? Or is that just a line you throw out like I do my movie look?
He pulled his license and showed her. None of the above. Like I told you before, I'm a private detective. She didn't look impressed.
Darren eats cops for breakfast. PIs are just a hiccup to him.
They might have met his match this time. I'm not in the fight alone. Her expression quickly changed.
You really think you can take him down?
Archer knew exactly why she was asking. If you can help me, I might. I'm sure you can see the personal benefits.
Is that why you'd be doing it?
I could lie and say yes, but until you told me of your connection, I didn't know you had skin in the game. But I guess in a way I did. If the Jade goes down, you don't have to go there and play the bad girl anymore.
You're not a preacher. You're a Boy Scout.
People keep saying that. Doesn't make it true. But do I want to make the world a better place? Yeah. Because I live in the world too. As do people I care about. Like you. Her face flushed beautifully when he said this, and she gave his fingers a squeeze before draining her Gibson. He finished his scotch, and both seemed now to hunker down to business.
How can I help you?
She said. Do you know where he gets his supply of dope?
No, but sometimes I've nosed around and seen the stuff coming in late at night. It's at least once a week. Comes by truck.
Surprised he lets you roam the halls.
Darren doesn't think I'm a threat, you see, because he has dirt on me. They put the empty crates behind that room divider in the entranceway. When the next shipment comes, the truck takes the empty crates away.
I also saw some smuggling going on in Malibu early on New Year's Day. A boat with crates coming into shore. I almost bought it then, too, on the beach. And I saw some of those sandy crates in the Jade behind that room divider, with what looked like heroin dust inside one. And I found a glass vial in one of the rooms with what I think is heroin, too. What I need to know, are shipments coming from what I saw happening on that beach?
They could be, but I don't know for sure.
He pulled out the photo he had snagged from the Bonhams' house. Have you ever seen these people at the Jade? She looked at the picture and then smiled at Archer. What?
The woman Darren moved on to before he divorced me.
Yeah? She pressed her thumb against Bernadette Bonham's elegant face.
That's the bitch.
Chapter 55.
So Bernadette Bonham and Darren Paley were a couple? Asked Dash.
He and Archer were in the latter's motel room discussing things over cigarettes and drinks, and sometimes muddled thought. Archer had given Dash the white powder traces he had taken from the dirt at the Bonhams. Dash had dropped them off at a private lab in L.A. he had used before. That's what Samantha said. Dash cracked a grin.
Samantha Lourdes! Who would have thought?
You've seen her pictures? Dash now snorted.
Hell, Archer, you seem to be the only one who hasn't.
And she was married to Paley for 2 years.
I think she can count her lucky stars she's still alive after living with that psycho.
She's not free of him yet, Archer pointed out.
And you want to be the white knight swooping in to save the damsel in distress?
I'm not a knight of any color, and she didn't strike me as the damsel in distress type. He paused. Bernadette would have entered the picture around the time Lourdes and Paley got divorced. That would have been around 1941. Bernadette told me her family moved to Canada to avoid Hitler when the Nazis took over France, and they were there until the war was over. France surrendered to Germany in June of 1940, so Bernadette and her family were in Canada before then. But she must have left Canada and gone to Reno, probably sometime in 1941. And she met Paley there. Then Paley joined up and was in the war for years. I don't know if he and Bernadette got together again after that, but they seemed tight now.
How long has she been married to Peter Bonham?
I don't know exactly. She told me they met after the war and were married in Nice. Then they came here. He already had the place in Malibu.
So at most, they've been married maybe 6 years, give or take?
Right. But Bernadette could have rekindled things with Paley even if she was married. The French look at these things differently.
Hell, Archer, Americans do too.
And she said that Bonham had been married before, but that his first wife was dead. Now, their neighbor, Mrs. Danforth, didn't think he'd been married before, but she had no way of knowing that for certain. Dash picked a bit of tobacco off his tongue and took a swallow of bourbon.
Okay, let's get down to basics, Archer. Namely, to nail Paley, we have to figure out what he's doing. Now, he's a guy with connections to the mob in Vegas. So if he's selling dope out of Chinatown, I'm sure he keeps some for the L.A. locals. But the excess probably goes out to the rest of the country through dope rings. And those dope rings, I have no doubt, have ties to the Vegas mob. It's a big moneymaker for them. Maybe even more than the casinos. But you said Paley thinks someone is horning in on his business?
That's right. Jake, have any insights on that?
No. But that doesn't mean we can't find out.
And I told you Peter Bonham is the man I fought with on the beach that night. Now I know he was there waiting on the dope shipment. I remember seeing a truck parked on the beach. You think Bonham is supplying Paley? Because at some point we have to make that connection or not.
Could be. And you say Bonham's the same guy who spoke to you on the phone that night when you called Lamb's house?
Yes. And that means he had something to do with Bender's death, because I'm pretty sure the man's body was there while Bonham was talking to me.
If Bender was killed by Bonham, he must have had a good reason. Dead bodies make things complicated.
Mallory Green hired Bender to track down who Bart was fooling around with. So how does Bender end up in Lamb's house?
We know he was shot elsewhere. Maybe Bonham killed him and dumped him there.
Why? And why? Asked Archer.
If Bernadette was cheating on Bonham with Bart Green, and Bonham found out, he might have killed Bender to keep that under wraps.
It's hard for me to believe that the lovely French lady would have much interest in Bart Green, his status as a big Hollywood producer notwithstanding. I thought the babes he had in Vegas were his mistresses, but turns out they were his nieces, and I got it from a reliable source that of the three musketeers, Simon, Bart, and Danny, only Danny is the skirt chaser.
I get that. But if Bart Green and Bernadette Bonham did have a fling, most cuckolded guys don't like their shame to be broadcast publicly. And you said Bernadette saw her husband arguing with Lamb?
That's right.
Lamb worked for Green, so maybe she found out about the affair and was threatening to tell the world if Bonham didn't pay up.
But why kill Bender? Asked Archer.
Bonham could have killed Bender and dropped the body at Lamb's place to get her off his back.
That actually fits together. Lamb told me she'd been getting strange phone calls, and someone broke into her house and left a bloody knife in the sink. And maybe Bonham's plan worked, because if she's not dead, she has vanished. So you might be right, Willie. Bonham could have been behind all of that to deep-six Lamb and her blackmail hooks.
And I also might be way off the mark, too. Only time will tell.
Dash put down his drink, looked at Archer, and checked his watch.
We'll head out to Malibu in about an hour. If I recall correctly, Danforth said the trucks were heard in the middle of the night?
That's right. And Lord said the shipments to the Jade come in at least once a week late at night.
Okay. Let's talk about the smuggling piece some more. Paley's selling dope. He knows Bernadette Bonham and possibly her husband, too. You tussled with Peter Bonham on the beach, and there was a truck there. So yeah, a possible connection between the Malibu beach smugglers, the Bonhams, and Paley is definitely established. And even though we don't know for sure what was in the crates being brought in off that boat, dope is certainly the most probable answer.
It all fits, agreed Archer.
But the Bonhams also go to France for months at a time. Who covers for him while he's gone?
He must have a partner.
Paley? No, can't be. Bonham is too smart to let Paley know the source of the dope. That way Paley could cut him out of the loop.
Right. And if Paley were overseeing the incoming shipments, he'd know who was drinking from his trough, added Archer.
So the trucks the girl heard were the shipments coming up from the beach, probably to Bonham's house. You were down on the beach around 5 in the morning?
Yeah. And those guys were rushing like crazy, because they were probably late. At that hour, you might get some early beachcombers, or people heading out to their jobs. Dash rose.
Okay, see you in a bit, Archer, and don't forget your gun.
Dash left, and Archer immediately called Callahan's number.
Archer, it's good to hear your voice. I miss you.
Same here. Willie is down here helping me.
Well, that definitely makes me feel better.
Hey, what can you tell me about Samantha Lourdes?
Samantha Lourdes? Why?
She was the actress I saw at the Jade. I finally made the connection. But she can't tell anybody. She's a good egg.
I won't tell anybody because I respect her as an actress. And she's also got a great head for business. I heard that Lourdes is close to getting out of her MGM contract and starting her own production company. She's sort of her generation's Carol Lombard. It kills me that she's mixed up in crap like that.
Well, she came by it in a weird way. He told her about Lourdes being married to Paley when she was 17.
God, she's lucky to be alive.
And I want to keep her that way, said Archer.
Wait a minute. Have you seen her again since the Jade?
Yeah, we had a drink at the Formosa earlier tonight.
I can't believe this is happening. What was she like?
Asked Callahan. Down to earth, smart, hardworking. She grew up on a farm in Minnesota.
I've been dying to meet her, and you run right into her?
Hell, Liberty. When I met her, I was running for my life at the Jade Lion. But I can tell her about you the next time I see her.
You're going to see her again?
Exclaimed Callahan. Well, we sort of left it open. But if I can get Paley out of her hair, I think I'd have a fan for life. Callahan didn't say anything to this. Hey, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Look, don't mention me to her, Archer. I'd hate for her to think I'm trying to use you to further my own lousy career.
But everybody in this town does that. You know that's true.
Well, I'm not. Not this time, anyway. But I'm happy for you, Archer.
Happy for me? Look, Liberty, I'm not marrying the woman. Just trying to help her out of a jam. Same as she's doing for me.
Okay, sure, if you say so. I got an early set call tomorrow. Good night.
Before he could say anything else, he heard the receiver click back into place. He slowly put the phone down and wondered what the hell all that was about. Chapter 56.
Something bothering you, Archer?
He and Dash were walking to the car.
No, it's fine. It's obviously not fine, so let's hear it.
Okay. I called Liberty, and it didn't go well.
Why? What did you tell her?
About meeting Samantha Lourdes. Archer went on to tell him the details of the call. Dash listened and said,
You just hobnobbed with one of the most famous skirts in Hollywood, and you told Liberty how swell Lourdes was, and how grateful she'll be to you if you get her out of this crap with Paley.
So you're saying Liberty's jealous?
I'm saying she's human.
The sky was rapidly growing cloudy as a storm system headed in. Archer observed this and said, You think they'll chance bringing a boat in tonight with this bad weather rolling in?
Dope smugglers can't necessarily wait for fair winds and following seas, Archer, and even if the boat doesn't come, they might be moving the dope from Bonham's to the Jade via truck.
So they probably don't take it directly to the Jade as soon as it comes in on the beach?
I don't think the timing works for that. They need to check the stuff, make sure it's all square. That takes time. And since Bonham might have other customers he's servicing besides Paley, my thinking is he's stashing it somewhere and then taking it to the Jade and the other places later.
Makes sense.
You got your camera?
Yeah. They climbed into the Buick and headed off with Archer driving. They made it to Malibu, drove up Las Flores, and parked around a curve from the Bonhams' place and behind a massive Chrysler station wagon. Archer settled back in his seat and took a drink from his flask. He passed it over to Dash, who declined. Dash looked around and said,
Nice neighborhood.
Yeah, except for all the dope smuggling and dead bodies, quipped Archer. The rain started to fall about a half hour later. Archer drew his dark slicker around him as the cold crept into the car. He felt his eyes growing heavy several times, but he would yawn and stretch to keep himself awake. Every time he looked over at Dash, the man was fully alert and staring out the window. At close to midnight, they both looked behind them as the pair of headlights came into view. Both men slunk down in their seats. The truck passed by them, rounded the bend, and disappeared from view.
"Give it another minute, Archer," said Dash.
60 seconds passed, and the men got out of the car and hustled down the street, rounded the curve, and then squatted down as they saw the truck parked in the Bonhams' drive. They watched as several men climbed out of the truck and disappeared into the backgrounds.
"Okay, Archer, hit it."
Archer ran forward, reached the truck, and squatted down. Then he used the light to locate the rear axle, took from his pocket what he had brought with him, and affixed it to the metal axle. He rounded the far side of the house and joined Dash, who had taken up a surveillance position there. The group of men from the truck had gathered around the site of the bomb shelter, while a tall man in the middle, clothed in a long black trench coat, bent down and unlocked the entrance. He lifted up the metal hatch and motioned the men inside. They headed down what seemed to be a set of steps. A few minutes later, they reappeared with wooden crates, and something else. People wearing white hoods, and whose hands were bound behind them. They swayed and stumbled along, as though drunk or drugged. Archer heard Dash say,
"Son of a bitch."
Archer shot multiple pictures with his Kodak, capturing clear images of Peter Bonham, who was the tall man in the trench coat, the crates, and the hooded prisoners. It was a montage of malevolence, with mood lighting provided by nature and preservation of evidence by Kodak, hopefully for future felony prosecution. Bonham shut the entrance and replaced the padlock. Dash whispered,
"Let's get back to the car."
5 minutes later, the truck appeared on the street and passed them heading down Las Flores. Archer waited until the truck was out of sight, then he started the Buick and followed. When the truck came back into view, Dash smiled.
Bingo.
The thing Archer had put on the rear axle was a reflective strip that fluoresced in the dark. They could see it.
"Stay back. Dollars to donuts, they're going to the jade."
Archer nodded and sat back as he lowered the car's speed. The crates, I figured. The people in hoods, I didn't.
"Looks like the scum are into selling dope and human beings."
"You figure they're coming up from Mexico?"
"The dope? Yeah. The people? Maybe from China, considering where they're probably going."
"What will they use them for?"
"The usual crap. Domestics, hard labor, farming, prostitution. Same old, same old."
Dash gave him the eye.
"This and bringing dope in over the border gets us to federal crime territory, Archer. Now, wake me up when we get to Chinatown."
Only the truck didn't end up going to Chinatown. Chapter 57. The first surprise was the turn the truck made before it reached Pacific Palisades. "They're heading north," said Archer. He thought for a moment. Will Rogers State Park is in that direction. Could they be going there for some reason? They kept following the truck, and later Archer cut the Buick's lights as the truck turned down a single-lane road surrounded by woods. "What do we do now?" he asked Dash.
"We can't risk being seen or getting stuck heading down the road. The rain stopped, so make your way down on foot and see what you see. I'll pull the car around and out of sight. I'm figuring they have to come out of there at some point."
Archer climbed out. Dash slid into the driver's seat and wheeled the car around and behind a slab of bushes. He cut the lights and engine and waited. Meanwhile, Archer picked his way through the wet ground as water from the rain-laden tree canopies splashed down on him. He turned up his slicker's collar and kept going, a flashlight his only source of illumination. His path paralleled the road leading in. He finally reached a clearing and peered around the trunk of a burly oak. There was another truck back here, and a transfer was being made. The hooded figures were being led off one truck and loaded onto the other. Two of the guards then closed the overhead door of the truck and secured it. One of them patted the back of the door, and the truck started up. Archer made his way back to Dash. He climbed into the Buick just as the truck with the prisoners emerged from the woodline. In a few hurried words, he told Dash what he had seen. As the truck passed by their hiding place, Dash said,
"We got a choice to make. Follow that truck with the people, or the other one with the crates." "I opt for the crates. We got the reflective tape on the truck. It'd be too easy to lose the other."
"Agreed." The second truck appeared a minute later and headed back down the way it had come. Archer and Dash followed at a discreet distance. They got back on the main road, made the curve around Santa Monica Bay, but instead of cutting east to LA and Chinatown, the truck kept going south.
What the hell? Exclaimed Dash. This is really getting screwy.
They kept following in light traffic. They passed the Venice Pier when Dash said,
Maybe they're heading to El Segundo or Manhattan Beach, something like that.
Now they're heading east, said Archer a minute later. The truck had indeed changed directions again and was moving inland. Then it dawned on Archer. They're going to LA International. Sure enough, the truck did enter the airport, which even at this late hour was busy. Archer looked around at the activity. Tugs pulled baggage cars, and multi-engine propeller planes taxied to or away from the runways now that the storm had passed. Cargo trucks zipped hither and thither to make sure the air commerce on the West Coast held up its end of the bargain. As they drove along well back of the truck, it approached a gate and stopped. The guard spoke with the driver. There was a flash of paper, and then the guard waved him on.
We're not getting past that gate, observed Dash. And the guard didn't even check what was in the back of the truck. I'm thinking some money has changed hands there.
Hold on. This is looking familiar. Archer parked the car and pulled out his binoculars. He hopped out and went over to a remote part of the field and peered through the fencing. The truck had stopped next to a plane. He continued to watch as the crates were offloaded, weighed on a portable scale, and then loaded into the plane's cargo hold. He saw the man in the truck hand another man some papers, then he and the other men climbed back into the truck. And Archer had recognized the man who had received the papers and the cargo. He returned to the car and climbed in. Okay, the plane they just loaded the crates into is Bart Green's Beechcraft.
You're sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. I flew in it, and the guy who accepted the cargo just now is Green's pilot, Steve Everett. He's the one who flew me to Vegas. They watched as the truck passed through the gate and headed on into the darkness. Should we follow the truck? Asked Archer.
I'd like to know where that plane is flying tonight.
I'm not sure how we'd find that out. It's not a scheduled commercial flight. It's private. We probably could find out, given time and a few palms greased.
Okay, we can do that later. Let's follow the truck.
However, the driver had now parked the truck and gone into the terminal, while the other men waited in the front seat. He came out a few minutes later with some paper cups of coffee in hand, climbed back in, and set off. As they left the airport, following the shiny stripe on the truck's rear axle, Archer looked up and thought he could see the Beechcraft pass overhead with its shipment of dope to points unknown. But that might just have been his imagination. They followed the truck at a steady pace.
Maybe we're finally going to Chinatown,
said Dash, as they passed in a northeasterly direction through south-central L.A., passed downtown, and hooked around Union Station. It did indeed look like they were finally venturing into Chinatown. However, when they rounded a corner, the truck was no longer in sight.
He must have turned down that alley,
said Dash, pointing to his left. At that same instant, three men stepped out from that alley, and they were pointing something at the Buick.
Hit it, Archer! It's an ambush!
Barked Dash. Archer gunned the engine, cut the wheel, and slammed down on the gas, even as the men opened fire, shattering the side and back glass of the Buick. Archer felt the crack of rounds whizzing past him, some lodged in the upholstery, others clanged off the metal inside the car. It was like he and Dash were stuck in a pinball machine, and ricochets were everywhere trying to kill the two men. He piloted the Buick around a corner and kept the pedal to the floor. The car's engine wound up high, screaming like a woman in distress. Archer exhaled a relieved breath as he slowed down.
Damn, that was close.
He turned to look at Dash, and his lungs seized. An unconscious Willie Dash was lying sideways in his seat, with blood pouring from his back. Chapter 58 Archer hung up the payphone for the third time at the hospital where he had driven the badly wounded Dash. He had first called Connie Morrison to tell her what had happened. She was on her way to L.A. He had next called Jake Nichols and woken him up. His response had been terse.
Come and see me in the morning, once they're sure Willie's in the clear. If things turn bad, call me any time, no matter how late.
He had finally phoned Callahan and told her what had happened. He could hear the woman quietly sobbing, and part of him knew that she was also thinking about what if it had been him who was shot and lying near death. He had put down the phone with her still weeping, because he was afraid he would start crying as well. The doctor on duty had called the police, as was required by law. While Dash was in emergency surgery, Archer had met with two uniformed officers and a plainclothes detective from the LAPD. They seemed to be honest and forthright and eager to do their job. And yet he left out everything except that they'd been riding in a car minding their own business when the shots had rung out. He had no desire to get into a lengthy explanation about everything until he knew what they were really up against. The plainclothes, in his 40s, with a calm face and low voice, said,
"You might just have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're cleaning this town up, but it's not all scrubbed yet."
"Could be gangs," said one of the uniforms, who looked too baby-faced to be a cop, and whose speech had a southern strum to it.
"Puerto Ricans or Chicanos, most likely. Or the coloreds. They don't care who they kill."
They had examined the Buick, and the surgeon promised to deliver the slug that was still in Dash to the police. Archford left his answering service number with them, and they promised to be in touch with regard to their investigation. Connie Morrison arrived just as her boss and former husband was wheeled out of surgery. Archer had never seen her look so pale and flustered in the 3 years he had known the woman. They met with the surgeon, who told them Dash had come through the procedure well, but his recovery would take some time, and he would be unconscious for a while.
"I think he's out of the woods," said the doctor, a short, thin man with a face as pale as his lab coat, but who possessed a reassuringly calm demeanor. He cleaned his specs with his coat sleeve and said,
"He is strong, certainly for his age, but he was also lucky. The bullet missed a major artery by about 2 centimeters, and didn't hit any bone along the way either. While he lost a lot of blood, I feel he'll make a full recovery. Somebody was looking out for him tonight."
Archer looked guiltily at his shoes. "Only it wasn't me."
They thanked him, and Morrison went to sit next to Dash in his private room. Archer knew she would be there every second of every day until her ex got up and walked out of the place under his own power. Archer stood behind her and looked down at the man who had become like a second father to him. Dash was alternately pale and gray, and his limbs twitched spasmodically in his induced slumber. The perimeter of a large gauzy bandage poked up from under the gown near his neck. He looked old and beaten, and nothing good. But it was good, Archer had to remind himself, because Dash was alive when he could so easily have been dead. Morrison turned to stare resolutely at him.
"I'll take care of the bills and all the paperwork, Archer. You just do what you need to do and find the ones who shot Willie."
He squeezed her shoulder and turned to leave.
"Archer."
He looked back to see her staring dead at him.
"Do not get killed."
He gave her a quick grin that died on his lips, because there was nothing funny about what she had said, meant, and felt. He nodded, lifted his hat an inch, turned, and left. He drove to the motel in Silver Lake, grabbed a few hours' sleep, rose, showered, shaved, dressed in clean clothes, and had some coffee. He turned in the Buick at a local franchise of the company he had rented at Drummond Baytown. He had to pay a substantial penalty, since the company was not fond of having their cars shot up. They would also not lease him another one for the very same reason. So Archer walked 2 blocks to an Avis office and drove out a half hour later in a gray 1952 Oldsmobile 2-door sedan. He headed straight to Jake Nichols' bar. The man was waiting for him inside. He was sitting at a table in his wheelchair, staring at the door like the worst news in the world was about to march in and crush what little life he had left. Archer took off his hat and said, "He's going to be okay, but it's going to take a while." Nichols wheeled himself over to a cabinet, took 2 glasses out, along with a bottle of whiskey, wheeled back over, and poured himself in Archer's shots.
"To brave men and lucky ones," said Nichols, with his glass raised.
Archer mimicked this movement, and each downed his drink in one swallow. Archer then told Nichols in greater detail what had happened during the night. Nichols quickly absorbed all of this and said,
"You got made. Guy goes into the terminal to get a cup of Joe, but also makes a phone call. The trap is set, and he runs you right into it."
Archer nodded, looking deeply chagrined. "That's the way I figured it, too."
"So selling people and dope?"
Archer said, "I don't know where the people went, but the dope didn't go to the Jade, at least not all of it. Some went on Bart Green's plane, which convinces me that Bonham and Green are working this together, and Green is the one drinking out of Darren Paley's trough, to use the man's own words."
"Then they're taking a big risk. You don't cross a guy like Paley unless you have a death wish."
"Bart Green's motive is clear. He has big gambling bills to pay. And if he doesn't, he's dead anyway."
"Okay. But how do you think Paley and Bonham hooked up?"
His wife knew Paley years before she was married to Bonham. They met in Reno.
And how did Peter Bonham get into the dope and slavery business?
Archer lit a cigarette and sucked on it. His elderly neighbor told me he once worked overseas, all hush-hush. She joked that he was a spy.
Maybe he got his drug connections when he was out of the country. Anybody check into his business? Where he gets his money, at least on the surface?
Archer shook his head. No, I haven't. But I guess maybe we should.
Let me deal with that. We know the guy's a smuggler, but he has to clean the money off his doping somehow.
Nichols poured another swig of whiskey into his glass. He held up the bottle, but Archer shook his head. Nichols looked at the liquid in the glass for the longest time, but didn't drink it.
It's not your fault, you know. Willie never saw it coming, so how could you?
I've been working this case solo for days. Willie really got on it just yesterday. I should have had his back. I should have suspected something. But I didn't.
You can blame yourself, but it's not helpful. You can see that, right?
Yeah, I can. Even if I don't want to right now.
He's a tough guy, and the doc says he's going to make it. If Willie was dead, we'd maybe be having a different and more difficult conversation. But right now, you need to keep focused on what's important. Paley will be thinking of nothing else other than this. You need to at least match the man on that.
Archer straightened and looked around the empty bar. You ever regret any of it? Doing what you did? Your life, your choices?
Since I'm human, the answer is all the time. You can spend half your life second-guessing what you did and didn't do, and in the end, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. So you can either live your life or pretend to have another one where you never made a mistake.
That may be the hardest thing in the world to do, Jake.
The easiest thing in the world to do is die. It takes almost no effort or time. You're here, and then you're in a grave. It's the stuff beyond dying that's hard.
What's that exactly? Nichols now drained his glass.
Living.
Chapter 59. Archer drove out to Malibu. The sky was clear, the sun warm but not too warm, the humidity non-existent. And still Archer was sweating. The investigation was close to getting out of control, and he had just lost for the time being the one man who had given him a decent shot to bring this case home. He stopped at a gas station and phoned the county cops. Two pass-throughs later and Phil Oldham came on the line.
Heard on the wire about Willie in Chinatown. How's he doing?
He's going to make it, but it was close. Too close.
You were there?
I was. How's the Bender case coming? Got the killer yet?
Why should I spill to you?
Oldham said brusquely. No reason that I know of other than we're both trying to get to the same spot.
We've made some progress. We fished his car out of the ocean.
I heard. You know a guy named Darren Paley? Manages the Jade Lion in Chinatown?
Is that why you two were there?
Do you know him?
I know of him. Is he involved in what happened to Bender?
I don't know, maybe. And you might want to patrol the western half of the Malibu beaches, say around 1 to 4 in the morning.
For what?
What do you think?
Smuggling? What?
The usual, replied Archer.
You seen this action?
Maybe I have. And it's not just dope.
What else?
Asked Oldham. Try people on for size. This seemed to get Oldham excited.
I want you to come in and make a statement and tell us what you know.
Why? I heard you boys weren't working extra hard to get Bender's killer. Oldham didn't answer right away.
Who'd you hear that from?
Is it true? Again, Oldham didn't answer right away.
Where are you?
76th Station in Malibu.
I'll be there in 15 minutes.
18 minutes later, the old Plymouth lurched into the parking lot of the gas station, and Phil Oldham rolled himself out.
Let's walk, he told Archer.
They headed to the beach. It seemed to be a popular spot for confidential talk, thought Archer. The tide was coming in, so they kept to high ground as the breakers covered their discussions and the seagulls fought against the wind in making their dives for mealtime. Oldham looked even pastier than before, his clothes grungier. But his eyes were bright and alert, and the man looked pissed.
Your source was right,
he said as they walked along. Oldham's hands were shoved deep into his pants pockets, and the remains of a stogie rolled around in his mouth.
Soon as we pulled the car from the water, I got assigned to another case.
They can't just sweep a corpse under the rug. Oldham shot him a glance.
Can't you, Archer?
I thought you county cops were immune from the LAPD disease.
Says you?
No, says you.
Then maybe I was wrong.
Oldham turned and hurled the stogie toward the water. I promised Bender's widow I'd find out what happened.
I checked into Bender. He was a good guy, but he had a lot of unpaid bills. They were threatening to take the house.
Archer stopped walking and looked at him. Seriously?
Yeah. I guess he'd borrowed big against it when his business wasn't doing too good. He couldn't make the mortgage payments. They were foreclosing on it.
But his widow still has the house.
That's because the debt got paid off. I didn't dig deep enough to find out how. I didn't have the chance.
But this sort of changes things.
How?
Archer looked off for a few moments and studied the breakers coming in. Even good guys can make bad choices when things get desperate.
How do you mean?
Archer continued to stare out at the rising ocean. And in that moment, certain things seemed to come together with startling clarity. How much was the mortgage on Bender's house?
What? Oh, about $5,000, something like that.
No private dick is going to make that running down regular cases in a couple of weeks.
What are you getting at, Archer?
Like I said, good guys make bad choices when they get pushed.
Are you talking about Bender?
I'm talking about all of us. Chapter 60. Archer drove back into town and dropped the film off from the previous night with the same guy and asked for another rush job. Then he checked with the private lab where Dash had taken the powder samples for analysis. A stern-looking man in a white lab coat confirmed to Archer that they were indeed heroin. Archer took the certified lab report with him and headed across town to Green and Ransom. Both name partners were in today, so he took Cecily Ransom first. She was dressed in navy blue slacks and an oversized dark green sweater that covered her narrow hips. She had on a black beret and an uncomfortable look as she sat at her desk with a pen in hand and a film script set in front of her. She laid her pen aside.
So, what do you have to report?
I brought a partner up here to work with me.
Okay.
He got shot last night in Chinatown. I almost did too. Ransom jerked forward.
What? Is he going to be okay?
Yes, but not for lack of trying by the guys doing the shooting.
Does this have to do with Ellie?
I think it does, yes.
Tell me what you know.
Strange things going on in Malibu. Trucks come and trucks go, and dope crates and people in hoods go with them. Ransom flushed so deeply, Archer thought she might collapse.
People in hoods?
Smugglers, Miss Ransom. A slavery ring. It's a business. Just a really nasty one.
Do you think Ellie found out about this and that's why she's gone missing?
Could be, yes.
Do you know who's involved?
Chinatown is involved, that's for sure.
The Jade Lion you mentioned?
I believe so, yes. Ransom looked down at the document in front of her, with her brow furrowed.
Then you may want to look at this.
What is it? She spun it around.
Ellie left this script for me about 2 weeks ago. She wasn't paid to write it. She did it on her own.
He read over a couple pages. Just give me the shorthand of what the story's about. Ransom's voice trembled.
Chinatown, the mob, dope dealers, and other things like a slavery ring. It must be a coincidence.
I don't believe in coincidences. Tell me more.
It's dark and violent. Very different from what I normally see from Ellie. Right on the edge. And it has a remarkable feeling of authenticity. Like she knows that world intimately. And it has a terrific female lead. I mean, this might have Oscar written all over it.
Why would she give the script to you?
Because she wants me to direct the film. And I think I might want to.
So the question becomes, how does she know that world intimately?
You said you found Jade Lion matchbooks in her desk. She might have gone there for research.
Archer looked dubiously at her. I don't see that happening. The guy who runs the place doesn't really like folks snooping around. I can personally attest to that. But something else occurred to him. Does she have a star in mind for the film?
Yes, she left a note about casting.
Ransom rummaged around and picked up a piece of paper. Before she could say anything, Archer spoke. Is the lead actress by chance Samantha Lourdes? Fear flitted through Ransom's features as she looked down at the paper she held.
Yes. What is going on, Archer?
A little piece of the puzzle just fell into place. But there's a lot more to go. Chapter 61. Bart Green sat at his large desk with a fat cigar crammed into his small mouth and a glass of what might be water next to him. But it also might be something stronger, too. He was dressed in a white shirt and a pinstripe vest with a red tie and gold collar bar. In the background, Archer could hear the soft purring of phones and the harsher clacks of typewriters, spinning tails to make money for Tinseltown and this man right here. You look a lot spiffier than in Vegas, said Archer, as he sat down across from the man.
I like to dress up for the office. Vegas is to play.
Speaking of Vegas, I had a nice chat with Darren Paley.
I don't believe he's capable of nice chats, replied Green snidely.
So you've had those chats with him?
I go to Vegas a lot, and he's there sometimes.
Did you ever talk to him about your gambling debts? Asked Archer.
Why would I?
Before he moved here to run the Jade Lion in Chinatown, Paley ran the enforcement squad for the mob in Vegas. It's what your little Tony used to do, and maybe still does.
So?
So Tony isn't your guardian. He's your executioner if your debts pile up again. Green drank from his glass and patted his mouth dry with the back of his hand.
Let's get something straight right now. You know nothing about nothing.
On the contrary, I can count to 2 million. Green gave a little belch, and Archer thought he could smell vermouth across the span of the desk.
I don't know what you mean by that.
It's what you've lost in the casinos.
I pay what I owe, end of story, and I don't always lose.
Yes, you do. And I know you'd pay your debts because you're still living. I almost wasn't. It nearly ended for me in the desert right after I left you at the Copa Room.
Then let that be a warning to you to keep your nose out of places it doesn't belong.
I'd have to change professions.
Then do.
Is that a threat? Green leaned forward and started speaking in a low voice. Look, Archer, as hard as it may be for you to believe, I actually like you.
I don't know why, but I do.
No, I do know why.
You're brash and willing to take risks, and you don't take no for an answer. In other words, you remind me of me when I was your age.
He paused and drained his glass.
Darren Paley and his kind are not to be messed with. I know you're looking for Ellie Lamb and all, and trying to find who killed that other PI. But is it worth your life?
Again, sort of goes with the territory. Speaking of Cedric Bender, are you sure you never heard of him before?
No. Why would I have?
Archer thought the man was actually speaking the truth, and that was troubling. You said you know the Bonhams?
I know them like I know most people. I've been to a party at their house. They're acquaintances. I don't really know them.
So you've never done business with them?
Archer, I don't even know what business the man is in. But I'd like to.
Why's that?
No one I ever talk to seems to know where all his dough comes from.
Lamb moved out to Malibu because she and Bernadette Bonham went to school together back in Washington, D.C.
I recall Ellie mentioning that her father worked in the government back east.
She paid over $72,000 in cash for her home and renovations.
Bullshit. Where would she have gotten that kind of money?
Not from you?
Hell, I could hire a half dozen writers for that.
Archer rubbed his jaw while Green said,
Look, maybe her family had money. Why don't you check with them?
You know, that's a great idea.
Now are we done here?
Sure. Is your wife out of town?
Yes, she's at our place in Lake Tahoe.
I hear it's fabulous.
It should be for what she spends on the place,
he groused. You never go there?
What is there to do at Lake Tahoe except stare at the water or the snow in winter? And most of the lake is in California. But could she pick a spot closer on it to L.A.? No, she has to go way up on the Nevada side. Bitch to get to in the winter. It gets snowy up there this time of year. Whole place can shut down.
Would you have a number for Lamb's parents?
Audrey, the receptionist, has information like that for the people who work here. Next of kin in case of emergencies, that sort of thing. And I suppose someone should tell Lamb's family that she's missing.
Thanks, and Audrey and I have met. Archer stopped at Audrey's desk and asked for that information. As the woman searched her files, Archer leaned over the counter and glanced at the switchboard located there. Above each number and switching port were initials. He saw CRR over one of them. Is that for Cecily Ransom? He asked. Audrey glanced where he was pointing.
Yes, her middle name is Rachel. We have enough people working here with similar initials that we had to start using their middle initials to distinguish them so I don't make an error transferring calls.
Archer looked at another number. And EDL? Audrey smiled.
Eleanor Dorothy Lamb. I know them by heart now, you see.
I do, see. Archer glanced at another set of initials, BMG, that he recognized from the aviation fuel invoice for the Beechcraft. He had thought BMG Incorporated, the company that owned the plane, originated from a combination of Bart and Mallory Green's initials. But this phone line label threw a wrench in that theory. And BMG is Bart Green, right? What's his middle name then? Michael or something?
No, that's Mrs. Green's private line, not her husband's.
This took Archer by surprise. But those aren't her initials. She's Mallory Green. Why is there a B then?
Because her full name is Belinda Mallory Green. She goes by Mallory because she prefers that to Belinda.
She pulled a piece of paper from the file, wrote something down on a blank sheet, and handed it to Archer.
This is the name and number that Ellie left us.
Archer glanced down at the information. Margaret Lamb. There was a DC area code and phone number. But Archer was still reeling from the initials. Does Mrs. Green own the Beechcraft?
I don't know anything about that. I've never seen it. Why? Does it matter if she does?
It sure as hell might, thought Archer. Chapter 62. He stopped at a payphone and called the hospital to check on Dash. After being patched through, he finally spoke with Morrison and found that Dash's vitals were improving and there was no indication of any problems. She also told Archer that the slug taken from him was a 38. He next made a long-distance phone call to the number in Washington, D.C. A woman answered and told him that Margaret Lamb was not in. Archer left the number for his answering service and told the woman it was very important that Lamb contact him, as it had to do with her daughter, Eleanor. The woman promised to deliver the message promptly when Margaret returned. He made one more call to a PI firm in Reno that he and Dash had used before. A woman answered the phone, and he asked for Jim Swinson. A man came on the line, and Archer told him what had happened to Dash. The only question Swinson asked was, "How can I help, Archer?" Archer gave him a short sketch of the case and provided Mallory Green's address in Lake Tahoe. He asked Swinson to get someone out there to keep the place, and Green, if possible, under surveillance. Some really bad guys are involved in this, so everybody needs to watch their backs. I'll have money sent up by Western Union to cover your fees.
Don't worry about that, Archer. Consider this one on the house. For Willie.
He got back into his olds and drove off. Chinatown, his destination. He found the alley where the shooting had taken place. The cops had obviously come and gone because the place was deserted. Archer got out, and one hand on the butt of his gun, walked down the alleyway. It was full of doors and windows and passageways, lots of means of getting in and out. When he cleared the alley, there was the Jade, right across the street. The truck must have done a quick turn into this alley, past the shooters, and kept going while they came out from hiding to fire on Archer and Dash. In the daylight, the Jade didn't look overly menacing. It just looked cheap and gaudy. Inside was not a den of iniquities, but a place where people did awful things to each other. exploiting weaknesses all humans had to varying degrees, wrapped around a bar serving one type of drink that, if it didn't kill you, might ironically make you swear off booze for life. He closed his eyes for a moment and imagined a scantily clad Samantha Lourdes bound to a bedpost so men halfway around the world could get their jollies. And then his mind pulled a dirty trick on him and transposed Liberty Callahan's face over Lourdes's. He opened his eyes and thought he really might be sick. You need to focus, Archer, like Jake told you to. You think you're taking down Darren Paley acting like this? Right now you couldn't take down a 16-year-old punk running numbers for a buck a bag. He retreated to his car, climbed in, and drove off. He got back to Wilshire and became immediately bogged down in traffic. In the distance, he thought he could hear a PA system in use and some sort of message echoing across all of L.A. In frustration, he finally parked his car and started to walk, making much faster progress on foot. He finally discovered that the PA system was attached to the roof of the station wagon. A sign was plastered on the sides of the car, which was crawling at a turtle's pace. Reds are everywhere. Be vigilant, be alert, and inform on traitors. And that was what the man holding a mic in the car was reciting over and over again through the PA system. Archer spotted a traffic cop at the next intersection and pigeonholed him. What's up with that? He asked. The man in blue grinned.
Uncle Joe's in town.
Uncle Joe?
Senator Joe McCarthy. He's speaking at the ambassador tonight.
He lowered his voice and said with a sour face,
This town is full of reds, buddy.
Is that right?
Half the movie people would line up to kiss Stalin's ass.
Joe Stalin. He and McCarthy have the same first name. That's kind of funny. The cop looked shocked.
What, are you drunk?
Smell my breath, nothing on it.
McCarthy is trying to save this country, and he should start right here. Commies all over.
Then why are you here?
Hell, the Union takes real good care of us.
Right, unions. You might want to take that up with Karl Marx.
Who?
Archer just had a sudden jolting thought. What time tonight is Uncle Joe speaking?
7.
Thanks.
You going?
Maybe. But I might get my hair cut instead. You have to have priorities these days. Archer strolled back to his car, got in, and turned around. He was heading to the ambassador, but not to get a seat to hear Uncle Joe. He had just had an improbable thought. It probably wouldn't pan out. But if it did, today would be a hell of a lot better than yesterday. Not that any day wouldn't be. He had a phone call to make first, and a question to ask. He could do that at the hotel, and then he'd take the automatic elevator all the way up again. Right to hell. And all this time, I thought it was the other direction. Chapter 63. Archer knocked on the door of the penthouse, and a few moments later the same young maid answered. She eyed him cautiously. Hi, I'm Archer. I was here yesterday.
Yes, sir,
said the woman, who did not open the door any farther. I'm here to see Mrs. Mars again. Can you let her know I'm here?
She is not seeing anyone today.
So she is here? The woman looked uncomfortable.
She does not want to see you.
Archer took out his notebook and a pen and wrote two words on the sheet of paper. He ripped it out, folded it over, and said, Show this to her, but don't peek.
No, sir, I won't. Please wait.
Oh, I will. A few minutes passed before the door was flung open with such force that it slammed into the wall. Gloria Mars stood there outfitted in a light blue dressing gown with a sheer lacy robe over it. Her hair was down and her hackles were up. She had a drink in one hand and Archer's note in the other. She flapped the note in his face.
What the hell is this?
Can I come in or do you want everybody to hear? She stood there silently for so long that Archer wasn't sure what her answer would be. Then he wondered if she had a gun hidden in the lace. She finally stepped back and waved him in. Nice day clothes, he noted, glimpsing her exposed cleavage before she pulled her robe tighter.
I was fighting a headache and I was almost there, and then you and your damn note showed up.
Where do you want to talk? She led him into a small room off the dining room, that didn't have a bed or liquor cabinet in sight. Mars settled herself primly in one chair while he sat in another. She held up the slip of paper.
"Explain this,"
she ordered, and it was clearly a command. Karl Marx. He was a German political writer.
"That's like saying Michelangelo was a house painter."
She balled the paper up and threw it at him.
"What did you mean by it?"
"You have Marx's collected works, 3 books about Lenin and 1 by Trotsky."
"They were in a locked armoire, you think?"
"You know what we PIs are like. Just can't trust us." Mars let out a soft groan and drained her drink.
I was afraid that might come back to haunt me.
"Not from me, it won't." She shot him a glance.
"Okay, then why are you here if not to blackmail me?"
"I'm not the blackmailing type, Gloria. I'm here to tell you that Joe McCarthy is speaking at the Ambassador Hotel tonight at 7. She looked at him blankly.
"You must be joking."
"Nope. There's a sign in the lobby, and a helpful cop told me this town is full of Reds. And that made me think about what you told me about Joe McCarthy when I met you the first time. You said the SOB's time was running out. Something to that effect. You're clearly not a fan."
"I don't like wannabe authoritarians who lie in order to destroy people who disagree with them. In that regard, I despise Stalin, too. Are you a fan of McCarthy's? Or are you not political? So many people aren't in this town. They apparently don't have the guts."
"I don't like stuffed shirts who wave little lists around without ever showing what's on them. And I thought this country was about letting people say, think, and believe what they wanted. If not, then how are we different from Stalin's world?" She glanced at him with a fresh look.
"Did I misjudge you?"
"We'll leave that for another time. And what I'm about to ask, you might decide it one way or another."
"Oh, great. Fire away,"
she added wearily, rubbing her temple. "Were you a member of the Communist Party at Wellesley?" She looked shaken by the question.
"I need another drink."
She started to rise. He said, "Just so you know, I don't give a damn one way or another." She sat back down.
"Then why did you ask me?"
"I asked you because I need to know if someone was blackmailing you because you were a communist." She stared at him with a resigned expression.
"When did you figure that one out?"
He tapped his head. "It's been percolating up here for a while. But I didn't assemble enough pieces until about 10 minutes ago. And then you said you thought I was here to blackmail you over the very same thing." He paused. $72,500? Sound about right?" She stiffened, and then slowly nodded.
"Yes, exactly."
"When did Eleanor Lamb put the squeeze on you?"
"You're smarter than I thought, Archer."
"You mentioned that Lamb might have come into some money before, only you knew she had. Yours."
"She came to me when she decided to move to Malibu and needed the dough."
"And you had all those trust funds handy and all."
"That was one reason I started looking at alternative political theories in college, Archer. I didn't lift a finger for all that money. I was just lucky enough to be born into the right family."
"They could give it away."
"I give what I can,"